Trivia contests and prizes. Don't let that home fall apart around you. Join us Saturday mornings from 8 to 10 on Around the House with Steve Gladstone on 1490 WGCH.
The opinions expressed in our talk shows are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WGCH Radio. And now, the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour on 1490 WGCH.
Good afternoon, Greenwich. This is Beth O'Malley at the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour, WGCH 1490 or WGCH.com anywhere. I am here today with Dr. Sona Mehra, and she is a pediatrician right here in Greenwich, and I'd like to welcome you here today.
Thank you so much, Beth.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us. Our show today is going to really look at the care of newborns and toddlers, and we'll talk a bit about different health issues that children face, and that parents and decision-making and safety issues that parents face as well. What I want to do, though, is right from the get-go offer up the phone number in case there are any new parents out there or soon-to-be parents. Feel free to call in. It's 203-661-5051. That's 203-661-5051. Now, Dr. Mehra joins us here from a Westchester practice. You were working at the Westchester Health Associates in Mount Kisco and then moved here to Greenwich.
That's right.
I'd like to just go back to share with our audience that you were a graduate of the Delhi University in India, and you did your pediatric residency at West Virginia University Children's Hospital here in the States, and then also at NYU at the New York University.
Uh-huh.
From there, you then went, you must enjoy traveling. You then went out to Portland, Oregon, and you were there for 7 years before moving back to New York.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So you've been back in this area for how many years now?
It's been about 11 years.
Terrific.
Over 11 years.
And so your children, who are 17 and 21, were raised here, primarily here on the East Coast then?
Yes,
okay.
That's right.
All right. Tell me, were you in pediatrics before you had your own children?
Yes, actually it's kind of interesting because when I discovered that I was going to start my residency in pediatrics is when I also discovered that I was expecting my first baby.
Oh, neat. Oh, that's terrific.
So yes, it's been quite a journey for me being a pediatrician and a mom, starting to do both around the same time.
Oh, that's terrific. I love it. Now, your 17-year-old, is he a senior?
She's a senior.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes.
And you
in high school.
In high school. So you have one going off to school, and then you have one who's currently at school. And
yes.
Where is he again?
He's a senior at Duke.
Terrific. Wonderful,
yes.
Wonderful. All right. So you know what I'm going through with this whole college application process. This
yes.
week, some early decisions come out for our seniors in town, and everyone's kind of on pins and needles right now. So what I want to start with is just the very beginning. When you first find out you're pregnant, we all of a sudden say, oh my goodness, I have to go and interview different doctors. And we ask all of our friends for the folks that in town that we can see. When we're doing those interviews, what do you recommend that we ask?
Well, your child is your most precious, is most precious to you. And first thing I think you have to make sure is that you're comfortable with the office and the doctors that you will go out and meet. Someone you feel that you can talk easily with, that you can express your concerns, that you can ask as many questions, as many number of times as you feel like you would need to. So you have to feel like a comfort level with the doctor that you choose. This is somebody that you're going to be calling in the middle of the night. This is somebody that you could be showing up in his or her office many times in the week. And so that's important. The other thing that you also want to make sure is that the pediatrician you decide to go with has been certified by the American Board of Pediatrics, because that kind of sets a standard for the care that your child will receive and, you know, the direction that you will be given toward being a better parent. So those, I think, are the two main things. You want to make sure that the office has some good parking spaces so that if you have to run in, into the office, you're not looking for parking forever around there. You want to be, you know, comfortable with the front staff. You want to make sure that it's nice and clean and personable. Everybody's nice to you. So I think those are the few things that you want to make sure.
And I shared with you earlier, I had my first child in Arizona and then my second child in Virginia. And it wasn't until I was here in Connecticut when I first started at the pediatrician's that I found there were two entrance ways when you arrive at the doctor's. So there was the well visit side for your regular checkups and immunizations. And then there's the side where you go when your kid's coughing and sneezing. And
Right. I didn't bring that up specifically because, yes, sometimes we do read, you know, in books or other places that look for a place where you have separate entrances or separate waiting areas for well babies and for sick kids. But research has shown that it probably doesn't make that much of a difference. And a lot of times when you have a small baby, most practices will get you into a room right away. So they don't like you to wait in the general waiting area. And it may be a little while before the doctor actually walks in, but you still get to be away from the sickness.
You just explained so much to me because there used to be no waits. And now, you know, I mean, the waits here in Greenwich are really not bad, I find. But now there are more waits that my kids are older. That's interesting.
Yes.
In terms of exposure to viruses, too, I remember, well, what I don't think that you're aware of is that my mom is an OB nurse, and also she was a Lamaze instructor and then a lactation consultant and certified lactation consultant. And so in that, she was, of course, an advocate of nursing. And one of the things that she shared with me that helped me to actually calm down as a new mom was that if a baby is nursing, that there's a way that the breast milk actually works in terms of fighting off illness. Can you speak to that?
Yes, definitely. She had a great point in that. We find that a lot of the antibodies that moms generate from being exposed to different viruses and different illnesses will tend to pass on into the baby, not only during the time that they're pregnant, but also when they're breastfeeding. And these do help protect the baby. And there are other substances too that are passed on in the breast milk that are protective for the kids, for the babies, and keep them from getting some of the illnesses. Mm-hmm. So yes, I absolutely endorse that and definitely promote breastfeeding as the best way to nurture our babies.
Right. When I was working at Stanford Hospital, I was in the social work department. When someone has just given birth, you get to go into and I'm not remembering what the unit's called, but where all the new moms are, newborn. Mm-hmm. And in meeting with the parents together in that first 24 hours, I, as a social worker, would talk a bit about there are different choices, and it's everyone's personal choice of how to proceed in terms of feeding. However, there's a lot of research about the health and wellness of a baby that has been nursed with breast milk, and also higher IQ scores, which...
Yes, possibly, yes. And less chances of... they say, you know, serious illnesses sometimes, like perhaps asthma, meningitis.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So some of that protective influence. I don't think that we know everything about the goodness in the breast milk.
Right.
And yet I do say that if moms get all the support they can get for breastfeeding and yet not be successful, you know, at breastfeeding, then it's better to switch to a formula, because
yes,
the main thing is that the mom should have as much of a stress-free experience as possible.
Exactly.
So though we do support breastfeeding and we want to do everything to make it happen, it shouldn't be the be-all, end-all.
Exactly.
Because that can affect the bonding between the baby and the mom also.
And it's an interesting dynamic in terms of nursing and thing, you know, when my daughter was born, I thought, oh, that's like a natural thing. It just happens. It's no work. It was a lot of work for her to learn to latch. I had mastitis twice or three times. I can't even remember. I actually had thrush, and so the baby's mouth had thrush, and we had to use this bright purple medicine. Oh, my
That's
goodness.
Right. We don't use the gentian violet as much anymore. We tend to use something a little bit, I guess, easier on the eyes. But
oh,
yes, it can be an issue.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. I am certain that if my mom hadn't been a lactation consultant, I would have been done at the very beginning. And then there was this wonderful support groups available for nursing
absolutely.
Moms.
Very necessary.
And I was at that time traveling for business to California almost monthly. So when you're nursing and you're a full-time working mom and traveling, that requires an enormous amount of pumping. Now,
that's right.
I have no idea how a young woman would do that today, because in those days I would go through with this big clunky pump and everyone at security would kind of look at me and say, what's that? And once I said what it was, they don't want to know anything else. They just let me through. But I'm sure today you can't get into the bathroom at an airplane and pump because you're in the air for too long.
Yes, it could be. And they do have, you know, easier to carry breast pumps, and I think workplaces are promoting a lot of the pumping, and if you can stay on schedule and do the pumping, that can keep up the breastfeeding and
mm-hmm.
help.
And so many places, you know, Nordstrom's right here at the mall has a breastfeeding room, and I see
absolutely.
Them everywhere.
Yes.
All right. So we kind of went on a little tangent about nursing and the importance of that, but that's one of the things that I'm a real stickler for in terms of health. The other piece that you said about choosing a pediatrician is the comfort level that you experience. And as a young mom, I had no idea how much the pediatrician actually becomes a part of your life. And you are on the phone. I don't know that there's any mom or dad who doesn't end up having to make middle of the night calls because a fever has gone up so high. Or I remember once one of my children was having hallucinations from too high a fever, and that's scary stuff. You absolutely need to. You want to get on the phone. You, at that point, you're so panicked.
That's right. And we encourage, you know, all kinds of questions. And you know, no question is silly or unimportant. So sometimes I know that parents feel like, should I really ask it? I mean, maybe I'll appear kind of, you know, uninformed or too immature to ask it. But really, you should go ahead and ask any question that pops in your head, because that's really the job we as pediatricians want to do. We want to let you know the right information. We want to reassure you, and we want to give you the directions to, you know, follow through and do the right thing by your child and your baby.
Yeah. In terms of coverage, what I'm finding these days is that I've become so comfortable with the different physicians in my children's office that if someone else is covering that day because I'm coming in with a child who's ill, it seems to be absolutely fine. There's such a nice working relationship between the different doctors. Now, who else is in your practice? I know that you're working with Dr. Loretta Cody.
Yes, so our practice is called the Children's Medical Group of Greenwich, and it is, you know, consistent of five of us. So there's Dr. Loretta Cody, there is Dr. Kate Meany, there's Dr. Steve Shiz, and Dr. David Hedrick. And they've all been here for many, many years. And in fact, there is some move toward now seeing the kids or the offspring or the babies of their own patients, you know, from several years ago. So they're on to the next generation. And
that's
it's really
awesome.
Beautiful that they're own patients have returned to them with their babies now and their children.
Yeah. You know, I had one of my very first clients when I came to working in Greenwich many years ago was seeing Dr. Cody. Dr. Cody was the pediatrician, and the involvement of the Dr. Meany, Dr. Shiz, Dr. Hedrick, their involvement from a psychological aspect as well. So it's whole body, and they're making the referrals that need to be made for a child who's having either anxiety in middle school or, you know, and even now I'm finding pediatricians are picking up on that anxiety disorders and depression even younger, and I'm getting referrals of third graders, fourth graders, fifth graders, and that awareness is so important because that wasn't the way it always was.
It's more like a team effort, mm-hmm. You know, everybody works together. And then, of course, now we also have the electronic medical records.
Yes.
And that makes it so much easier in terms of communication between us all because
that makes sense.
Yes, it's accessible. It's accessible at home to us, right. You know, if a patient calls up and we need to know what medication they were put on or if they have any allergies or what their past medical history is, we can just check it out on our laptop, and it makes it a lot easier.
That's a lot different from when you were on call years ago and you'd have to have a rundown of every... Wow, that's terrific. Okay,
yes.
Good. Now, in terms of... I want to really talk a little bit today about immunizations, about sleeping and putting children to sleep and getting them to sleep on their own, as well as growth and development of babies, and really keep our focus on the younger child. What I'd like to do right now is take a little bit of a break, and then we will be right back. I'm going to also offer our number again for when we come back on the air. It's 203-661-5051, and I'm here with Dr. Sona Mehra, and she is available to answer any questions that are pediatric related or child related. And this is Beth O'Malley at Be Well with Beth on the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour, 1490 WGCH.
From the WGCH Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Dr. Bill Evans with your Doppler weather radar forecast. WGCH brings you up-to-the-minute weather 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Good afternoon, everybody. We're getting sunny breaks now, and we're going to be looking at a temperature of about 46 degrees. Tonight's skies will clear out a bit more. The low tonight, about 36, 37 degrees. We'll be looking at sunshine tomorrow. The high gets to 47, but late in the day it gets cloudy. Tomorrow night we have rain coming in. The low should be 42. This is meteorologist Dr. Bill Evans for 1490 WGCH.
This is Margaret Walsh of Greenwich Library. Another unique exhibit is set to open in the Flynn Gallery at Greenwich Library. Reclaim, Reprocess features five contemporary artists who have applied their talents to create works of art that utilize discarded materials and the byproducts of today's consumer culture. This timely exhibit addresses environmental concerns while delighting viewers with aesthetically exciting pieces that reflect the same ingenuity that inspired earlier generations to craft patchwork quilts and rag rugs. Reclaim, Reprocess is a visual tribute to artistic imagination unleashed to call attention to today's environmental concerns about waste. The exhibit opens Thursday, December 8th with a reception from 6 to 8 p.m. There are also other programs related to the exhibit, including a showing of the film Wasteland and artist talks. Please visit the library's online events calendar or call 622-7910 for more information. I'm Margaret Walsh of Greenwich Library on 1490 WGCH.
We're here with Dr. Sona Mehra, and this is Beth O'Malley at the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour, 1490, or WGCH.com from anywhere. And I am here today with Dr. Mehra talking about pediatric care and having how to pick a pediatric office, which we just discussed quite a bit. But what I'd like to talk a little bit about are immunizations. And that's such a hot topic the last really 10 years or more in terms of safety and schedules of immunizations. And when I'm working with the young parents around issues of care with their children, I'm still finding that there are some myths out there, and so I wanted to kind of touch on those today. Again, if any callers have any questions about immunizations, feel free to call in at 203-661-5051. But there's sometimes a bit of a fear or concern that I see. And there's such a difference today in terms of how immunizations are stored and safety. Could you speak to the improvements that we've seen over the years and also to some of the myths?
Right. So immunizations are, of course, a very, very important part of your pediatric visits, about how we ensure that the children remain safe and protected from some of these illnesses that definitely exist out there. Having said that, we are not seeing a lot of that illness, and that's because the kids have been immunized. So it's like when parents stopped doing the MMR vaccine, what we found was there was a resurgence of measles and mumps, and these are serious illnesses which made a comeback because now there were certain places in the country where the parents got worried enough that they didn't want to give these vaccines to the children. So definitely, your pediatrician is going to follow the schedule that is set by the American Academy of Pediatrics. And we tend to immunize starting right from the day of birth in the hospital where we give them their first hepatitis B vaccine. After that, the vaccines start to pick up again at 2 months of age, 4 months, 6 months, 9 months, and then at a year. And it follows into the second year of life at 15 months, 18 months, and 24 months of age. So, yes, there are a lot of vaccines we give to them, and to have the concern is logical on the part of the parents. But these are all important vaccines. They've been researched. All the data shows that there is nothing to worry about. There are no side effects. There is no reason to believe that they're in any way connected to autism or any other behavioral disorders. Mm-hmm. And what they really do is just keep the kids safe. To keep the baby safe.
Yeah, when I speak to parents, young parents, about that fear of autism, and I often bring up the work that was done. I believe it was in London that was really found to be falsified information.
And that's absolutely correct. And I think the group of doctors that did that were actually disbarred.
Yes.
From the profession.
Yep.
And many, many different researchers tried to replicate the same studies, and they did not come up with any of the conclusions that this particular study had shown.
And yet this is really an urban myth that might be one of the most significant urban myths in the history, of our society, and it spread throughout the world where people were refusing to vaccinate because of faulty research that was done.
And it was to do with the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, the MMR. And they found that there was some association with the autism. But really, what happens is that it gets a bad rap, this vaccine, because it is given around 12 to 18 months of age, which is about the time when we are starting to see social and communication skills coming up in the child.
Yes.
And if they're going to have autism, that's when these deficiencies are going to be seen, and it was incorrectly associated with the fact that the vaccine had been given, and therefore the changes were happening.
Exactly, right. When we're given the vaccines, there has been some concern expressed by young parents in terms of the other ingredients that are not necessarily the vaccination, but
the preservatives.
Right.
So, yes, there was some concern about preservatives, especially those that were found to have mercury in it, and that was the thimerosal. And thimerosal was added because it helped to keep the vaccine protected from bacterial overgrowth, and therefore safe for the child. But then what they did was, even though they did not find on the research and data that thimerosal was causing any harm, they still did decide to remove it from the vaccines.
Okay.
And therefore now we have single dose vaccine vials. So if you're at your pediatrician and you want to find out if they have preservative-free vaccines, it's a question that you can ask. And most vaccines today are preservative-free.
Oh, that's
interesting. And that's just an added precaution. Even though there was never any documentation that they were causing any harm, the preservatives or thimerosal, but still to be on the safer side, the CDC and the other organizations that there are that are looking out for the safety did promote that we remove we have the preservative removed from the vaccine.
Terrific. Would that be the same for the flu shot then?
Yes, same for the flu shot too. So you can get single-dose vials for that also.
Oh, great. About how many years ago did that transition happen?
Yeah, I think for the flu shot, or most of the shots, the transition happened in the past, I would say, 10 years.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think it's been about 10, maybe even 12 years now.
Okay, good.
Yes, 10 to 12 years.
All right, that's great news to hear. Now, one of the things that I always find fascinating is when a parent is saying that they're too anxious about having the vaccines and they're still looking at, I'll have them do the research so they'll move through the fear of from the faulty research on autism and that myth. Once they've moved through that, having the fear of just immunizations just as a blanket. And there's some parents just have an anxiety around that. And one of the things that's interesting is a lot of folks don't realize that many of these shots are really required in order to participate in child activities like sports, camp, sleepaway camp, mm-hmm. and even going to school.
That's right.
Can you explain how it is that, you know, we hear that it's optional, but if it's optional, then how would that child go to school? I always get confused on that.
Yeah, I mean, most of these vaccines actually are not optional, and they are required. Sometimes, I think based on religion, they can be excused from it, but some states have come up with legislation that says even those don't work.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yes. And that is basically because these are, again, deadly illnesses, and they can lead to other morbidities that are lifelong, even if they don't kill.
Okay.
So these diseases have to be prevented. The vaccines have to be given.
Yeah.
And usually in our practice, and I think that's what most pediatricians do, we do want to stick to the schedule that the American Academy of Pediatrics requires. But sometimes parents will tend to space out the shots. So they may not give them all at the same time. And we are willing to work with parents, you know, if that will help, because it's better to get them done, even though it may be on a little bit of a delayed schedule, rather than not getting them done at all.
And as I'm listening to you speak, when you say that will help, and what's interesting about that is that you're really helping the parent be at ease and comfortable
Correct.
In administering the medication. It's not that it's helping the baby. The baby's really fine either way. But a lot of parents have a very extreme anxiety around immunizations in particular. I think we all, when that little one comes out, we're all anxious about everything
yes,
under the sun.
Yes, we want to do the best for them.
Right.
Absolutely the very best. And that's another reason where I think that it needs to be understood that as pediatricians, we want to do the same. And so far as our knowledge that's available today, we would definitely not be doing these shots if we even had the slightest inkling that it's not the right thing for them.
Well said.
So we do want to do the best by the child, by all the babies we see, all our patients, and the families we take care of.
Now, there's something very interesting that our generation has been broken into, but when I mention it to my parents' generation, they're completely unaware that there are now immunizations that are offered very it's a standard care for now both boys and girls in their I think it's 7th-8th grade where they receive the shots. There's a series of three shots.
Yes, the Gardasil,
or
the HPV, the human papillomavirus vaccine.
Right,
that's right.
Which is an STD.
It is an STD. More so, it is a virus that can cause cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So, therefore, more than it just being an STD, which is definitely how it is transmitted, but it is important to get that vaccine on board. And that is probably one of the other vaccines today that we do see a little bit of parental resistance to.
Yes.
Because sometimes the parents don't have all the information.
Right.
But once I think they get the facts and they understand that it's a leading cause of, you know, cervical cancer, and these are the viruses that we are trying to prevent, and also cancers in boys. And
in boys, what would the cancer be? Is it throat?
It's the oropharyngeal as well as penile cancers.
Okay.
So these don't occur as often as the cervical cancers do in women and girls, mm-hmm. But there's definitely the same virus that causes these to happen. And if it's very rare, but if you're one of those that gets that cancer, it doesn't matter how rare it is.
Right.
And if you could have been protected and prevented from getting that, and it's a safe vaccine, and as years go by and we've been using it for so many years now, we realize that it does have a good safety profile, it has a good efficacy profile, and it's something that we should definitely give to the kids sooner rather than later.
Am I correct in understanding that that vaccine in particular, the Gardasil, is only effective when given at a younger age, that if you're over 40, for example, it really doesn't
yes.
matter?
I think it's usually most protective if you get it before you get sexually active.
Oh,
so once
okay.
you have been exposed or have had the chance to be exposed, it may not be that effective.
So that's why you're giving it in middle school.
Giving it in middle school. Also, studies have shown that when kids get it at a younger age, their antibodies are the response of the, you know, for the production of the antibodies to the vaccine, it's much higher and better as opposed to getting it at a later teenage years. Because sometimes parents want to wait and say, well, they're not quite there where I'm really worried about exposure. But again, studies are showing that kids that get it between 9 to 12 years of age actually mm-hmm. will have a much better response to the vaccine than those that are older.
Oh, that's really helpful information. And I think that's what it's an emotional response as well when the parent comes in and says, why would you want to vaccinate my nine-year-old is not
Correct.
Sexually active.
So at this point, we're doing it more like in the age group of 12 to 14.
Got it.
But if they were to get it younger, there's absolutely an advantage to it and no downside.
Good to know. Okay, great. Well, we are going to take a break and then come back and talk a bit about putting babies to sleep, starting food, and the growth and development of newborns. This is Beth O'Malley at Be Well with Beth on the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour, WGCH.com or WGCH 1490 AM.
From the WGCH Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Dr. Bill Evans with your Doppler weather radar forecast. WGCH brings you up-to-the-minute weather 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Good afternoon, everybody. We're getting sunny breaks now, and we're going to be looking at a temperature of about 46 degrees. Tonight's skies will clear out a bit more. The low tonight, about 36, 37 degrees. We'll be looking at sunshine tomorrow. The high gets to 47, but late in the day it gets cloudy. Tomorrow night we have rain coming in. The low should be 42. This is meteorologist Dr. Bill Evans for 1490 WGCH.
Hi, I'm Lisa Wexler. Join us every weekday on this station between 4 and 6 o'clock p.m. Hey, if you're thinking about it, we're talking about it. We're listening to what's happening in our community, and we want to hear from you as well. We talk politics, science, and the arts. We consult with experts, and we want your opinion. So join us every weekday. I'm Lisa Wexler right here at 1490 WGCH and WGCH.com anywhere.
Hi, this is Beth O'Malley. Good afternoon. I'm here today with Dr. Sona Mehra on Be Well with Beth at the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour, WGCH 1490 or WGCH.com from anywhere. After the show, you can also listen to it again if you want to hear us a second time, and that will be on my Facebook page at Be Well with Beth O'Malley Wellness. So welcome back, Dr. Mehra.
Thank you.
I wanted to talk a little bit about sleeping and feeding schedule routines for babies. And I have to be very honest with you. This was the hardest part of parenting for me, was putting my children to sleep away from me. I didn't want them out of my arms.
So. Yes, that's natural. And I think a lot of parents struggle with this. But really, setting good habits in place at the right time will go a long way, both in terms of making life easier for the moms and dads, but also in setting a nice routine for the child.
Yes.
This is an important part of what I have in my discussion at every well child visit that I see with my families. And my goal is to have the baby sleeping through the night by 3.5 to 4 months of age. Really? Which means they're going 9 to 11 hours uninterrupted by themselves in their crib and not getting any feeding at all. During that time.
That did not happen in my household. I probably broke every rule.
Well, it's not easy because, you know, sometimes the babies will do it themselves, but sometimes they need a little help along the way. And often with the first time around parents, I have to say the success rate is not as high as it is with the second time around parents.
Yes,
because
yes.
They're like, tell us what it takes because it was hard that other time, the first time, and we'll do whatever you tell us to do. And
yes.
Basically, it's just being consistent, just like you want to be in any other way with your child, you know, in terms of anything else. And once the baby knows what is expected, and that there's not going to be any picking up and rocking and being taken into their parents' bed, and they're not going to be fed. Once they get that realization, and they do even at that young an age, then they know that all they have to do at that time is sleep, and they will sleep.
Wow. Yeah, I'm amazed with how many young parents that I work with who are able to have their children sleeping through the night so much more effectively than we were in my day. And I think when I had my first, everyone was reading attachment parenting books, and I think I walked around with my attachment parenting book as the Bible, which it was fine for me and is
yes.
probably still fine for some women.
Absolutely.
But I know that there are ways that the parent can take better care of themselves.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
So we do encourage it. And, you know, as the baby's growing, we tend to go longer and longer during the night without the feedings. And it may end up being a couple of nights here and there where the baby is waking up to cry and wants to be fed, and you have to be strong. And it's what we call tough love.
Uh-huh.
And say, you know what? Nope. This is not going to happen. And once you're consistent with it, then yes, the baby gets it and they start to sleep. And it's a much healthier situation for everyone in the house.
Yes. I wonder if that routine would work with my puppy. I have a puppy who wants to go out four times a night. And I'm not getting any sleep.
A little bit out of my area of expertise, but yes, that would be good.
All right. In terms of a feeding routine, what's being recommended these days in terms of when we start to introduce solids?
Right. Yes. So definitely, you know, we start out with breastfeeding or formula, you know, whatever works. And in the first month of life, you really don't want them to be on any routine so they can feed as and when they get hungry, especially if it's a breastfed baby. And then usually at between 4 to 6 months of age, we introduce solids and like to give them everything pureed till they're about 9 months of age. So don't want to give them anything like a finger food till they're 9 months of age. In the first year of life, there should be no honey that should be given to the baby. You know, sometimes that can cause infection from Clostridium and what we call botulism, which can cause the baby to end up in the hospital. So no honey, you know, and we wait for whole milk again till a year of age. Some studies are starting to show that perhaps giving them peanut butter before a year of age might reduce risk of allergy to peanuts, but As of now, the American Academy of Pediatrics hasn't come out with any policy there, but I think there is some stuff out there that parents are reading and getting confused as to whether they should wait on its introduction till a year of age or not.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yes. And usually there's a protocol in the way we introduce the solids. You know, we start out with cereal, then we go on to vegetables, to fruits, and finally to meats, and everything, again, pureed initially. And it's advisable to start one new food every 3 to 5 days so that if, God forbid, there's an allergy and the child breaks out in a rash or starts to throw up, then there's no confusion about which food that was.
Yes.
And you can
yes.
back off on that one and try some of the other things.
Are parents still making their own? When we were having children about 15 years ago, everybody was making their own puree from organic vegetables. That was really kind of a hot thing.
Right. I think there is some of that going on now too.
Terrific.
But it all depends on how much time, again, the parents have. You
right.
know, if mom is working full time, maybe she doesn't have the you know, the time or the energy necessary to do that. We do have a lot of good foods available, you know, over the counter that are organic and hopefully safe. So I tend to usually discuss all the different options with them and let them go with whatever's convenient. Because I think at the end of it, you really want stuff to be as easy and stress-free.
Yes.
Because that's the best environment for the child to grow up in.
Yes. So. I mean, we had a little group of moms where we were doing, we would make extra and then trade. So
that's a great idea.
It was really fun, yeah.
That's actually a great idea.
One of the most important parts of young development is healthy touch and also socialization. So I wanted to speak about those two topics a bit. One, when I run Positively More with the sixth grade girls, I find that the teen mentors, the 12th, 11th, 10th graders, are giving advice in terms of what they understand the studies from the orphanages and why hugging and touching and showing affection and love is so important. Can you speak to that from a medical standpoint?
Yes, I think that is very important because it's a way we can communicate our love and caring to our child. A couple of things that come up in my mind are that, you know, one is the skin-to-skin feeding, like right off the back. You know, when the baby's born, we like to do that, give skin-to-skin touch to moms with the baby right away. The other thing that comes to mind is, you know, the shaken baby syndrome, where, like you said, it has to be done in a healthy way.
Right.
It has to be gentle because it doesn't take much for, you know, babies to get hurt if we shake them too hard or, you know, if we hold that arm or leg in just the slightly wrong way. So that's why it's really important to make sure that, you know, things are healthy overall and that it's a positive environment and that the mom is in a good place and that you're getting your sleep at night, where your baby's sleeping through the night, you know, just what we just recently talked about, and that we're not pushing them into corners, the parents, where it's hard enough as it is and trying to get used to doing all these different things.
Right.
So, yes, I think we do talk about, you know, the right kind of care, the touching, the face-to-face with the baby, you know, talking one-to-one. And as much interaction as possible.
And is it accurate that today they're introducing the skin-to-skin contact not only with the mother in the birth room, but if the other parent is available, that the other parent then has skin-to-skin contact?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think you can't do enough of it if it's done in the right way.
And it has to do not just with touch, but also scent, correct? Or not? Is that more of a myth?
I'm not sure that I've heard a lot on that front or read a lot on that front. But, of course, one of the things we do say is try not to, you know, wear too much with scent, like in terms of perfumes or soaps or creams or even use detergents because it's extra chemicals. And I think the natural, you know,
that makes sense.
Yeah, the natural smell or the natural body smell or the cleanliness or the hygiene is probably more important.
Okay, good. In terms of adoption, are you working with families with adopted children here?
Yes, we do. Of course, it's not the majority, but there are families that tend to adopt not only locally but from many other countries, you know, like in South America, in China, India.
Are you seeing more? I remember seeing a lot of adoptions of my daughter's friends. That was about 16 years ago, were Russian children that were coming over from the orphanages. Are we still seeing that? And are you seeing more from one country versus another?
No, I think there's a pretty good mix of different countries. Like I mentioned, you know, South American countries too, Russia, China, India, yes. And then we see it from all over the world.
Terrific.
Yes.
I have
even the other Eastern European Bloc countries, you know, like Romania and places like that.
It's amazing to me that children, some of the children that I work with who are adopted children end up looking like their parents.
You know, I've been struck by that many times too. And it's hard to tell that they're not really their kids.
Right.
I mean, of course, you know, there is some cross, you know, racial. There is some features that, of course, you know, are different. But yes, there have been times where if the background is somewhat similar, it's very hard to tell the difference.
It is incredible.
I've been struck by that too. Yeah. Absolutely.
I don't know what makes it happen. I don't know. Yeah. You see it also with husbands and wives. After several years, they start looking alike.
Something to be said about rubbing off of each other, I guess.
Right. Okay. Now, there's an illness that was very common down in Virginia, and all the parents knew about it. But up here, when I mention RSV, not everyone has heard of it. Can you explain a little bit about what RSV is? And I know that after you have RSV, it somewhat mimics asthma, although is not asthma.
Yes, it's actually a bronchiolitis, really, which is a disease of the small airways in the lungs. And RSV stands for the respiratory syncytial virus. And it's a virus which pretty much causes respiratory difficulty, prolonged cough, a lot of runny nose, sometimes fever, and sometimes even hypoxia, which is decreased oxygenation.
Okay.
That leads to babies being admitted sometimes.
Yes.
But this is more of an illness that's serious for children up until about 2, maybe 2.5 years of age. Beyond that, older kids, adults, we can all get the RSV infection, but it usually manifests just like a cold.
Okay.
So like a regular cold. But in kids that are below 2.5 years of age, and the younger they are, the more chances of it being more severe. And then they end up being on nebulizers, and, they can get ear infections, they can get secondary pneumonias.
So ear infections could be related to RSV.
Absolutely, they can be.
And can you have RSV more than once in your life?
You can. You can get it, except as you get older, the manifestations of it are not that serious.
Okay. What's the longest you've had a child hospitalized for RSV? Because down in Virginia, kids were being hospitalized for 3 to 5 days.
Yes, I think that's pretty much what we see here too. Usually the first week of illness with RSV is the most critical time.
Okay.
So depending on when they start to get sick and how sick they are, that's usually about the time that you may end up having them in the hospital for supportive care and closer observation.
And the support to the parents around that time, it's crucial. Having friends and family visit in the hospital, because you don't want to leave your infant's side when they're hospitalized.
That's true.
And the beds are set up in such a way, I don't know if they're different here, but they pretty much look like they're cribs, but they kind of have a bit of a prison-like feel to them in terms of that the child needs to be safe at all times in the hospital.
I mean, generally, we do have like beds in the room, you know, at least one bed for the parent.
Yes.
And we do like one of the parents to stay over, because there can be somebody in the room all the time in terms of nursing staff. So it's good to have the parent there, not only just because the child would want the parent to be there, but also because it's good to have them for closer observation.
Okay.
You know, if there's, and help.
And what would be a symptom where that's when you really, as opposed to my child just has a little bit of a cold, how will I know to bring the child in for something that's more serious?
Yes, it's usually like if they have fever, they have breathing difficulty, they have lots of coughing, wheezing. Sometimes they can have color changes, where they may turn blue.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're not eating well, so appetite changes. There might be dehydration, fewer wet diapers than usual in a 24-hour period. So it can be a gamut of, different symptoms.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yes.
Are there any other illnesses that we should really look for that are of concern in the first or second year of life?
Another big one at this time of the year is influenza. So with the flu, that we worry about.
Do babies get the flu shot?
Babies can get the flu shots after they're 6 months of age. So 6 months and older are definitely, candidates for the flu vaccine. Mm-hmm. But prior to that, we do advise that their caregivers get the flu shot. So anybody that's around the kid should get the flu shot so that they don't get the illness to then transmit it on to the baby.
Okay. And in terms of the flu shots, I know that the children are usually given a choice at a certain age between the nasal.
I'm so glad you bring it up, because there was the option of the nasal vaccine.
Yes.
And it was an option for 2 years and older, kids, but it's been taken off the market.
Oh.
So this year, in fact, we have no alternative for the kids because it was found to not have helped prevent the flu illness these past 2, maybe even 3 years. So studies showed that it had not been effective. And
that's
as a result of that, it actually was taken off the market this year.
That's what my kids have had.
And studies are continuing to find something that would be more effective because it definitely helped improve the vaccination rates.
Yeah.
But as of this year, nope, the parents are not being offered that alternative for their children.
And just for our listeners who are not familiar with the nasal swab, it's a swab. It's not a nasal injection.
It's a nasal spray.
It's a spray.
Yes.
Got it. Okay.
Nasal drops, yes.
Yeah. All right. So we're back to injections this year for the
That's
children.
Right. Okay. That's all we have.
In terms of any other issues or concerns that children might demonstrate at, you know, when we were talking earlier about immunization and the link to autism, one of the points that you made that I found so interesting was that it's around 18 months or so where you might start seeing issues show themselves. And for some parents, there's a concern or a fear where they're running in and asking questions. But then for other parents, they're unaware completely of some of the differences their child might be exhibiting.
Absolutely.
And I'll tell you, one of the most interesting situations I ran into with that was a eighth grade boy was brought in inpatient for mental health inpatient hospitalization. And he had never been diagnosed on the spectrum. He was very much so on the spectrum. And his mother happened to have been an expert in the field. She was not a physician, but in a type of field that was only working with children who had autism. So it was amazing to me that her son was in eighth grade and it had never clicked that all of the symptoms he was demonstrating were really, you know, spectrum issues. Speak a little to what we're looking for when we're concerned about.
In fact, you know, I think we are seeing less and less of that happen because we are starting a lot of questioning at a much earlier age.
Great.
So we have a lot of developmental, screens that we have set up where we ask certain questions that parents have to fill out sometimes before the appointment, during the appointment. So there are developmental screens like that. Like there is the ages and stages questionnaire. There is the MCHAT. There is CHADIS. There are a lot of these developmental screens that we do periodically at the different, well-child exams that the children come in for. And basically, autism is to do with social and communication skills. So even as early as 6 months of age, sometimes you can pick up because you're looking for babies to interact with you, to make eye contact, to start recognizing their name. And that may not happen. At 9 months, they're starting to make monosyllabic sounds like mama, dada. They don't know who is who, but they're definitely making those sounds. They're responding to the no that you shout across the room they're giggling in response to how you interact with them, or they're crying if you raise your voice. So those are the little things that you can watch out for. And then come a year to 18 months of age, you're looking for some words to start appearing, the mimicking. The ability to let the parents know what they want, if not by words, by pointing. So those are the things that we tend to focus on and we tend to ask about.
And what you'll often see, I'm sure, is increased irritability or frustration in the child and acting out, because if they're not able to express their needs, if I can't communicate, then it's tough.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. And we definitely, I see a change. When I first started working, that was at least 20 years ago, and a child was not making the words or, saying the right number of words, we would give them time. But that's changed now. So if they're not saying the required number of words at a certain age, we are very quick to refer.
Terrific.
For speech evaluation and intervention.
Wonderful. All right, great. Well, I can't thank you enough. Would you be able to give the phone number that our listeners could reach you at?
Yes, absolutely. You can reach me at 203-661-2440. This is the Children's Medical Group of Greenwich, and we are located at 42 Sherwood Place, Greenwich, Connecticut.
Terrific. Thank you so much, Dr. Sonia Mehra, for joining us today. This is very informative, and I look forward to having you back on future shows.
Thank you. Enjoyed myself greatly, too. Thanks, Beth.
This is Beth O'Malley at the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour. Be well with Beth. 1490 WGCH or WGCH.com from anywhere.
You're listening to the station you grew up with.